This is fast.
I told you it was going to be tight.
Glad to have you with us for Political Rewind today. I'm Bill Nygut. It's day 39 down at the Georgia legislature. They only go 40 days. They're not working on Monday. Well, they're working on Monday. They'll be deal-making like crazy all day at the Capitol on Monday. But day 40 will take place on Tuesday, and there is still a lot that has to be resolved between now and then, including some of the most high-profile measures that we've seen all session. So we're going to talk about that plus much more on today's show. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC, is with us. You read him on Wednesday and Sunday in the Wednesday and Sunday papers, and you also see him because he oversees the Political Insider blog. Hey, thank you. By the way, you were caught up in this mess. For those of you who are in Metro Atlanta, you know that the police stopped traffic on I-75 all morning to chase some bad guys.
And you had to know the back roads of Cobb County to get here on time.
And, which you do, Galloway. Thank you for making the effort to be down here. We're glad to have you here. Ed Lindsay is with us, former Republican member of the U.S. House, of the Georgia House. Yep. From Atlanta, and now a partner at Denton's, the world's largest law firm, where you oversee the Georgia practice, government relations practice.
I appreciate being here on a very busy day 39. My team is probably listening to this show back at the Capitol, wondering where the heck I am.
I'm glad you're here, but you were there all morning,
right? I was there all morning, and I'll be there late into this evening.
All right, we'll be looking for insights from you about how things are unfolding down there. Audrey Haynes is with us. She made the drive in from Athens, Georgia. She's a professor of political science at the University of Georgia. We're glad to have you here, Audrey.
Glad to be here, as always.
You have a bunch of your students from the Applied Politics program, where you work with students to teach them how to go into politics for a living.
Yes, we do.
And they're all down at the Capitol, right?
They're all down at the Capitol, and they're working very hard.
Yeah. All right. Well, they'll be working hard these last few days, that's for sure. And Michael Owens is with us. He's the immediate past chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party. You are one of the cybersecurity experts now at Equifax.
Yes.
Which seems like such to me, politics, cybersecurity, they do go hand in hand. But we're taking on Equifax and the problems they've had has been a big deal for you.
Yeah, I mean, that was it's one of the things kind of in my DNA. When there's a problem, I want to run to it. You know, and Equifax did have an issue that we had back in 2017.
An issue was a lovely way of putting it.
And but you're right. I mean, the confluence now that we have between cybersecurity and politics, I love it because it takes my two passions and just, you know, put them on a crash course to each other. So, you know, I'm excited to be doing the work that I'm doing at Equifax, but just as excited about how cybersecurity is now taking a front and center role.
Yeah.
And I like to say I now fight Russians in my political career and my
You know, Galloway, Owens, now that he stepped down voluntarily from chairing the Cobb County Commission, the Democrats up there loved having him there. You've got to wonder if at some point he might think about running for an office.
Yeah, you wonder if you know, somewhere in the 13th Congressional District, might be a place for him. I know that there is a Democratic congressman named David Scott who hopes that's not so.
Well, you went a little further with that than I was going to, but we do think maybe we might, by mid-April, get some sense of where Michael Owens is going. I think there's a lot of Democrats out there who are intrigued by him. So, all right, let's talk. First, Jim, let's start by talking about a couple of the controversial measures that have just passed down there. The first one being the Confederate Memorial Bill. Jeff Mullis introduced this in the state Senate. It passed yesterday. The House approved it as well. This is the bill that would set new penalties for people who deface Confederate monuments. And probably just as important, it passed, and what did not was a bill returning to local control the fate of Confederate monuments.
Two things to keep in mind. Number one, SB 77, if you want to take a look at the contents, is sponsored by Jeff Mullis of Chickamauga, who happens to be the Senate Rules Committee chairman. Mm-hmm. That's a very powerful position. The bill was changed, I believe, slightly in the House, which means it's going to need reaffirmation in the Senate. So it's not a done deal. It would triple the penalties, the penalties on defacement and repair costs, I believe, and it would require local governments who've moved monuments to give them an adequate display elsewhere, which I pointed out this morning, that was not done with the Tom Watson statue in front of the state capitol.
Tom Watson,
he was grandfathered in.
Yeah.
Well, grandfathered out.
This bill, there was a heated debate yesterday the House floor. There are Democrats who were very angry about this measure. Mullis has insisted from the start that we have to preserve our heritage.
Yeah, well, one caveat to about this bill, it doesn't just involve Confederate monuments, but it involves any historical markers or monuments and protecting them. And therein lies an interesting struggle that we have in particular here in the South, as you know, as we become more sensitive to some of the darker sides of our history, is how much of it to glorify and how much of it to remember and how much to simply place in greater context. You know, one of the places that I'm most interested in is Stone Mountain, which, you know, was first created as sort of but created as a Confederate memorial. And you have the etching on the side of the granite mountain. A lot of us, for instance, don't necessarily favor taking that off, but would prefer to have something like a memorial to Martin Luther King and a bell tower put on the top to commemorate not just his life and his memory here in this state, but also his 1963 speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, in which he called out Stone Mountain and some of the darker parts of its history. And, you know, I think that would be a very fitting memorial and would, quite frankly, put other things about what happened, what exists out at Stone Mountain in better context.
Yeah. Michael, there does seem to be a bigger and bigger movement now toward contextualizing rather than removing, so that at Stone Mountain you do something to honor Dr. King, maybe in Decatur, in the courthouse square, where you do have a real lost cause monument, you find some language that talks about what the lost cause means, whatever.
Yeah.
That does seem to be, and Michael Thurmond is one who really believes in that contextualization.
You know, I've heard that, contextualizing, and I look at it from the standpoint of, let's put it in a context, right? Let's put it in a context of not heritage, but put it in a context of this was treason against the United States of America, right? I mean, the fight was to secede from the Union. That's exactly what this was about. So, you know, I don't know anywhere else in the world, you know, we understood that this say that victors tell the story, right, of history. I mean, history is told by the victors, those who win. And this is one of those unique cases where that is not the fact, right? I mean, history in this sense is being shrouded in heritage, and to basically say that, you know, this was, I don't want to say it's okay, you know, we can talk about the fact of, you know, whether it's celebrating it or whether they're trying to contextualize it. I mean, I agree with telling the whole story. Both sides of the story, I think, is important. I think when you have ancestral people who have lived in the South and their great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents may have fought in the war, I understand there is some value to remembering that. But in the grand scope of things, I don't know anywhere else in the world that we're going to honor people who fought to tear down a country.
Let me, real quick, because I want to get you in, Audrey. But Jim, help us with this. There is nothing in the language as it now stands that would prevent a local community, or is there, from adding to memorial, for instance, a sign that contextualizes or something. Do you know
no,
off
no,
top?
No, no, no.
They can still do that locally.
They can still do that.
Okay.
And I'd have to go back and read the bill carefully. No, I mean, in terms of upkeep and repair, I'm not sure that there is any insistence on that.
Okay. Audrey, I want to play a soundbite and ask you to respond to it, and then let everybody get a crack at this. And I want to, going in, I want to say that this was not a remark that was endorsed by many Republicans. This was not a position by the Republicans in the House. The Speaker very quickly got past it, put it to the side. But it is a reflection of just how heated the debate can become. And from my point of view, it tells us something about the impact of President Trump in how we talk to each other. This is Representative Barry Fleming commenting during that debate.
That a placard shall be placed at the base of Stone Mountain, which reads, "In 1958, Georgia Democrats funded the project to have the following Democrats put on Stone Mountain: Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Thomas Stonewall Jackson, in order to commemorate Georgia's role in the Civil War, which was started by Democrats, seceding from the Union and being the party of slavery and later Jim Crow. One reason to keep monuments in Georgia from being destroyed, which this bill does, is because it reminds us of the past. And I would remind you what Georgia was like when Democrats ran the state. And we should keep those reminders around so we don't return to that."
So, Audrey, as I said, I didn't see any broad endorsement from other Republicans in the chamber for what Barry Fleming had to say. But the very fact that you get into the well of the Georgia House of Representatives and accuse the Democrats of being the ones who, I mean, it's true that Democrats were historically in a position they were the party of slavery at some point, but this is now 2019.
Yes, and the first thing I would say is I would love for him to take my political parties course so he could actually learn about the dynamic nature of parties and how they can change significantly. And the labels may change, but the movement. So right now, we would look back and we would see that Democrats back in that day were the status quo. We don't want to change things. And over time, we've seen a realignment. And a lot of the people who are status quo, don't want to change things, now tend to be Republicans.
From the Civil War through the World War II, Democrats did advertise themselves as the party of the white man.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay, but right. What we're missing here is that we swapped name tags somewhere around in the 60s, 70s, and 80s with Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, the two Bushes, and Donald Trump, and now Republicans are the party of the white male.
Yeah, again.
Well, as a Republican white male, I'd like to just simply point out that a lot of us view our party a little bit more broadly than that.
Yes,
it is a representation of what's happened. You know, we see this going on in Washington every single day, Michael. But the Georgia legislature has, in many ways, tried to have more civil, cordial debates than that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think no doubt that what you see from Washington is definitely leaching down into state legislature. I think it's happening all over the country. And I think part and parcel, that is what we know we've seen since Donald Trump has taken office. There has been a general degradation in decorum all around, and we're starting to see that.
Well, having served in the General Assembly, I can tell you, particularly when you get around day 38, 39, 40, a lot of the decorum goes out the window when you're in for a very long time.
Yeah.
I believe that we need to keep this in context. The General Assembly still here in Georgia does push forward with a lot of bipartisan legislation that tries to make sure the trains run on time and the children are well educated.
I'm glad you point that out. You know, by date, you're right, by day 38 or 38, you know, the secret to a lot of the reality TV shows is they don't let these people sleep very much, so their nerves are frayed. Yeah. And that's kind of what happens down to the General Assembly by day 38, 39.
The unfortunate
39.
Thing about that statement that's made, though, it is, it's in a way trying to say, well, Democrats, you own this, right?
And it was unnecessary.
Absolutely, yeah, really, I mean, it's misinformation that hopefully that some people will latch on to and regurgitate.
Right.
There's no basis to it.
I wanted to play that and get your response, and I appreciate your giving it to us. Jim, they passed the budget.
Yes, they did.
The only thing that the General Assembly is required to do is pass a budget. Everything else is frosting on the cake.
Right, and which means if we get into a heated, if the arguments become too heated, if the disparities become too great, they can always bring the gavel down and everybody can go home.
Ed, during your tenure, were there 40-day budgets? Budgets that weren't signed until well into the 40th day of the session?
Yeah, we had a few times in which well into the 40th day the budget came forward. Those were often a lot of our lean years, quite frankly. When we were just sort of looking underneath the cushions, looking for dimes and nickels and quarters. I do remember, I think it was the 2009 and 2010 budget in particular, when we had to go from a $21 billion budget down to about a $17.4 billion budget. Those were rough years, and I chaired one of the education subcommittee. I can tell you it was really rough.
This year is $27 billion.
It's the biggest budget ever passed.
And, you know, it has continued to move up as the state's population has increased and, quite frankly, refilling some of the coffers that had been depleted in the previous years. But, you know, we also did have one year in which we did get out on day 39. Get back to Jim's point. There's no constitutional requirement. They have to stay to day 40.
Right.
They can leave a day early. Right. And I think it was 2005 that we actually sunny-died on day 39.
Audrey, the budget includes $3,000 raises for teachers. Brian Kemp promised on the campaign trail he was going to give them big raises. He said $5,000. It became clear that it was going to be staggered over several years. But a $3,000 down payment isn't a bad start for the governor. It's a victory for him in some ways, I think.
No, it is. And that's a huge constituency, a very active one. So by delivering on that promise, that is a good way for him to start his term.
And he's got 4 years to come up with the other $2,000.
Yes.
And I point out in terms of getting back to the issue of how much bipartisanship, I believe there were only four or five no votes in the House. So this was a very strong bipartisan budget.
It's a no-brainer almost, right? I mean, if you find ways, and as government, we have to find ways to do things and spend money where we know we need to spend it. And spending money on teacher salaries is, I think, I'm surprised it wasn't unanimous, but I can't think of anybody who wouldn't want to give teachers a raise.
He also gave a raise to Audrey Haynes, I think. I think 2% in the higher education.
That's why you got a birthday present.
Thank you. Jim, so that's a victory. That Governor Kemp in his first session as governor can claim. And the other one, of course, is his Patients First Act, which gives him the power to determine what kind of waivers to ask for Medicaid and for the Affordable Care Act subsidies.
Right, and I think the most important part of that is that it's a reassertion of the governor's power within the governor's office. In 2014, when Nathan Deal was running for re-election, you had some legislators get worried that he might go for Medicaid expansion. They took that power away and put it in the hands of the legislature, and now it's back in the
governor's. Their fear was that if Jason Carter, the Democrat, were to beat Nathan Deal, then he almost certainly would want to expand Medicaid with the powers that the governor had at that point. Now it's back. Ed?
Well, to add to that, in terms of what they did today, and saw part of that same component, with the seeking the Medicaid waiver, a big part of that component is continuing the provider fee that's required for Medicaid. That passed this morning
as
well.
This is what we call the bed tax.
Republicans call it a provider fee, whatever. but you know, it raises, you know, for every dollar that's increased through the provider fee, the state gets $4 from the federal government in terms of Medicaid reimbursement. So it's a good trade-off. But we not only had that, but also the governor and the lieutenant governor and the Georgia Hospital Association came together this morning and also passed a update on CON. Certificate of Need, which hasn't been updated in about 10 years. So that's another win for the governor and the lieutenant governor. And also the hospital association is pleased as well.
All right, so we'll put Certificate of Need to the side for a few minutes, if you don't mind. Michael, you know, so the Governor Kemp in his first session is having some victories that he's going to have the right to brag about. At the same time, we're still waiting and wondering what is going to happen with the birth, the heartbeat abortion bill.
Yeah, that's it is one I can tell you from the Democratic side. We're still fighting every hour, every minute, every second to stop this bill. You know, it's and I've said before plenty times, this bill is something that Brian Kemp ran on. But as we get closer and closer to this bill, the number of people, sheer people we see turning out at the Capitol is nothing like I've ever seen before. You know, so and then you go into the text of the bill itself, and there's a lot of problems there. And you start off with just the heartbeat itself and the name of it, 6 weeks, right, when most women don't even know that they're pregnant. And, you know, I don't want to go into the full context of the bill, but there's a lot of problems there. And I'll tell you, I'm really, really proud of Senator Jen Jordan and the speech that she gave, which I think was very impassioned. She got, it was some hard personal things I think she let out. But, you know, to get really to the heart of the issue, and here you have this picture that there's a bunch of white males that are, in essence, telling women how they should control the reproductive health.
I want to continue this conversation because it's an important one, but I want to get a break in right now. And when we do, we'll come back, and I want to bring everybody else into this part of the conversation, including the question of whether some Republicans are beginning to get cold feet about this because it's drawn on for longer than it might otherwise have. So let's do this. Let's take our first break of the show, and we'll be right back with more on Political Rewind.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227, and thanks so much.
I'm Ira Flatow. Mathematician Stephen Strogatz joins me on Science Friday to talk about the calculus you didn't learn in college. Plus, National Poetry Month is right around the corner. We'll talk to the U.S. Poet Laureate and a poet physician about where science fits into their craft. All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today at 3 on GPB and GPBnews.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. Just want to remind you that on Monday night, April 8th, we will be in Audrey Haynes territory. We'll be in Athens, Georgia, on the campus of the University of Georgia, where we're going to do our show in front of a live audience. We're going to talk about young people and politics today with a big crowd, we hope, of students from the University of Georgia. So if you still want to come out and be part of that show, be in the audience, we'd love to have you there. Just go to PoliticalRewind.org, and you can save yourself a free seat. We're looking forward to being out there, Audrey.
We are looking forward to having you, too.
Jim, I said it before the break, there has been some concern that this abortion bill has lingered for so long that it's causing some Republicans who would have otherwise supported the measure to wonder if it's a good idea to do it.
Well, there are two factors for Republicans. Number one, you have Georgia Right to Life, which is a no exceptions organization, no abortion and no abortion even in the case of rape, incest, or life of the mother, and so they fear that they've come out against that bill, and they fear that that might rob them of one or two votes. But you also have the situation in the northern arc of Metro Atlanta, where you have really what we saw in 2018 was a revolt among college-educated women, especially in the 6th and 7th district. Yeah. And one thing I wrote this week is Lucy McBath had a very, very interesting closing ad in November, in November 6th, 2018. It was the first ad that I can remember that was a pro-choice ad. It led on with an attack on Karen Handel for it accused her of criminalizing doctors who perform abortions. It was the first TV thing, TV ad of that nature that I've seen since early 1990s.
Yes. Well, and I was going to add to that, and the fact that, you know, if you look at Georgia as a state, one of the things that is interesting is if they really wanted to lower the levels of abortions that take place. The number one factor is contraception, ease of access, cost, and we don't do very well in this state on that. So that is problematic. If they were going to put forth this bill and add an additional component to make contraception more accessible in the state, you know, they might have some more support. But we don't do very well. In fact, I don't think that we have actually one law that allows pharmacists to deny, to not give the emergency day after medication. So, you know, all the data, all the research suggests that contraception is what has been actually lowering it. There have been over 1,000 restrictive laws post Roe v. Wade across the nation. And most of the analysis shows that places that actually have more access to contraception have lower rates of abortion than even the places that
are. And I haven't even heard that as part of the debate down there in any of the conversations going on.
You know, the overall debate has been very heartfelt on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, and you're absolutely right that Jen Jordan's speech in the well of the Senate was very heartfelt and was an excellent speech on her part in terms of personal history. You also had on the other side, you had Ed Sessler, who is a child of adoption, who spoke of the fact that he was born in 1969 and has to wonder whether or not if he was conceived in and came about in 1974, whether or not his teenage mother would have aborted him or not. So you had that very heartfelt. I also, you know, my state representative is Deborah Silcox, who voted against the bill.
Republican.
Who has very strong moral opposition to abortion, but nevertheless didn't feel that it should be that it should drop down from 20 to heartbeat. And so she gave a very heartfelt.
You're a vote counter.
Yeah.
And you say that you got a different count than maybe that a lot of people suspect.
Well, you got to remember this is that, you know, the margin was very close. It was only passed with 93 votes and the legislature needs 91 in order to pass. But there, if you drill down and you look at who was actually on the floor and who wasn't, there were four very strong pro-life representatives who were not on the floor. So if you add them into the mix, you now have to, in effect, flip eight seats by the eight people to vote no who otherwise voted yes.
Are any of those ones who may have chosen not to because they did not want to take that vote?
Some folks, keep in mind, there were also some folks who were not on the floor who probably will vote no.
Yeah, I mean, I want to make...
But what I'm saying is that in terms of you got 93 votes plus another four, so you're up to potentially 97. Now I do imagine that there will be maybe that you may lose one or two or those, maybe three of those. But it's awfully hard on an issue like abortion. For the most part, folks are locked in one way or the other. Awfully hard to go from one position or another once you have to hit a green button or a red button.
Michael, it's important to remember here that this is a simple agree-disagree vote. This was passed in the House, went to the Senate, they made changes, now it's back to the House. There's no conference committee working out the problems here. At any moment, Setzler can call for agrees or disagrees with the changes.
The speaker, of course.
So this could happen in an instant.
It could, but I hear what Ed said, and I want to also go back to what Jim was saying, that some of those Republicans who chose not to cast votes, I think, was for a reason. And there is elections coming up, and votes, in this case, votes have consequences. And this is a situation to where, man, there are a lot of eager people that's ready to vote these people out of office. So I think some of those state representatives have to think long and hard about making that vote because they're going to have to go back and face their constituents, who many Jim talked about in the northern suburb metro area, and there are a lot of activists and a lot of volunteers are going to be trying to win those seats.
One last thing about this.
Let me make it a little more
real quick.
It's not just going back to your district. You got to go home to your spouse somewhere.
There you go. Oh, that's great. Jim, they could have taken this up at any moment, and yet they still haven't. Maybe late today, I think you believe?
There are many reasons for keeping a bill like this off the floor until the very last minute. Number one, you put a lot of pressure on whatever party you're trying to address to keep their people in line and active in other votes. Look, House Speaker David Ralston did not want to see this particular bill come up. Brian Kemp, the governor, decided he wanted it to move. It wouldn't surprise me if David Ralston were making the governor kind of sweat a little bit here.
Okay, but there's no reason to think it won't come up by the end of the night tonight, probably the end of day 39.
I think it's guessed that they'd want to get it.
Meanwhile, it's making national headlines. I was reading Michelle Goldberg's column in the New York Times today. Now, Michelle Goldberg is, of course, one of the most liberal columnists the New York Times has, but there accompanying her column was a color photograph of those women dressed as handmaidens from Handmaid's Tale in front of the Capitol. So we're getting the national spotlight that perhaps Georgia doesn't really want or need over an issue this controversial.
It's a heartfelt issue. And what I'll tell folks, and this is the hardest thing that I can imagine, is that, you know, it's very difficult to embrace two conflicting principles in our society.
Yeah.
One is the right to be left alone, whether you be man or woman. And that includes the right to control your own body. The second one is the protection of innocent life.
All right,
and they're in conflict here. And that's, and at some point, we're going to need to be able to have that honest conversation.
Okay. Jim Galloway, here's one of the most important questions of the session. What is a Franken bill, and how does it apply to the Hartsfield-Jackson takeover by the state?
Well, a Franken bill, it's kind of like a Christmas tree, if you will, where you've got a lot of things tacked onto it. This one, though, I think is a little bit it has been constructed a lot more deviously or smartly, depending on what side you're on. Okay, we had the Senate airport bill passed the state Senate. Burt Jones was the author. It passed into the Rules Committee.
Saying, we want the state to take over the operation of Hartsfield-Jackson Airport.
Right now, extremely opposed by the city of Atlanta.
Right.
All right? The city, it was sent to the Rules Committee, which generally is a traffic cop, okay? In this case, it was a place where the House Republican leadership could keep close watch on it and could design it to their whim.
Because David Ralston had said from the beginning, I have yet to be told why we need to do this.
Right.
So go ahead.
Okay, so you've got Kevin Tanner getting up before the Rules Committee and making what I think is probably one of the biggest bets of it is the biggest bet of the session. Okay, you take the takeover bill and you convert it to an oversight commission, kind of like MARTOC, that doesn't look just at Atlanta, but it looks at 9 other commercial airports in Georgia. All right, you toss in the Delta jet fuel tax. All right, which the Senate does not like. And then, for good measure, you take up a statewide transportation system.
511.
511, right. that the Senate also doesn't like, and you load that into that sucker.
So what we've got here, Audrey, is a very specific effort first by the House to reject the state takeover of Hartsfield that the Senate had voted for, to add the Delta fuel tax, which the Senate seemed to be prepared to punish Delta over for their not wanting to support the takeover. And then you get, as Jim says, this bill that would help people across the state with transit and other kind of ride sharing opportunities.
Well, and this is one of those areas where you see that sort of the rules do sort of help, you know, bring it back to a more palatable outcome. Because one, with all of the questions about some of the contract stuff that happened with Adam Smith and so on, there may be a need for some oversight. At the same time, if you look at, I was actually reading through the financial reports of the airport, they've been doing very well. I mean, they bring a lot to the city, and it's very complicated legally, I think, for the state to take over. And in opposition to what Burt Jones was saying, the state may support them, but it's really the TSA and the federal government that puts everything in there.
So, Michael, are we in a posture now where the House votes for this big Franken bill, it goes back to the Senate, and the Senate's already angry enough about this? This whole thing could die before day 40 ends.
Well, I thought that the takeover bill would be dead on arrival anyway.
Yeah.
I didn't think, you know, between Ralston, Speaker Ralston not heavily supporting it, between, as Audrey had said, I mean, I think the airport has been a very well-run organization, years and years of success behind it. It works very effectively and efficiently.
And so, Delta was against it, too.
And Delta was against it as well. So, I mean, you had that trifecta there. I figured it was dead on arrival. And so I think it goes back to the Senate. I don't think it has much chance getting out of there.
Jim and Ed, what do you guys
think? Let me ask you this, though, to both of you. Yes, I think it's a well-run airport. And I'm a resident of the city of Atlanta, and my city owns it. And I'm not really sure how somebody takes over the operation of something that they don't own. But we have to concede that there has been a long history of problems, particularly in the procurement area of that airport over the years. Why doesn't, and I consider myself a fan of Mayor Bottoms. I don't agree with her on everything, but I'm generally a fan of her. She's still new in her administration. Why doesn't she simply come in and go, look, I'm going to clean up the things about the Atlanta airport that haven't worked well. I'm going to create a city authority, and I'm going to appoint 9 people to it, and I'm going to put a barrier between the mayor's office and the operation of the airport to take away some of the problems that have happened in the past. And that's what I would really love to see my mayor do during the off season. And I'm using this bully pulpit here to advocate it. and that, I think, would take that issue off the table from a state. And I think the folks in the city of Atlanta would love
Jim?
To see that as well.
Okay. To Michael's point, there is a possibility, even a likelihood, that this bill could collapse under its own weight.
But there's
also a gamble that the Senate could take a portion of it. Okay, and you could see that happening. This bill passed the House. The Franken bill passed the House. I think with 70 dissenting votes, all Democrats. There were a few that didn't. One of them was Calvin Smyre, a Democrat, the dean of dean of the House. What that tells you is that if this thing does go to conference, he will have a seat at the conferees table, and he will be representing Mayor Bottoms and City of Atlanta in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to watch how that unfolds. But that bill, I don't think we should be expecting the state takeover to happen anytime soon, actually. Medical marijuana, this thing has changed. I think the Senate has now passed, Ed, right, a version.
Yeah. A much narrower version.
Huh?
A much narrower.
Much narrower.
Version.
So the House had approved, first, the most important thing was that there's a breakthrough. The legislature is now agreeing that we should have some production of marijuana oil for medical purposes in
this
cannabis oil in the state, and we should have distributors. I think the House started with 10 distribution centers.
60 distribution points.
Ten growers. Now it's down to like
two growers.
But I think the main thing to look at, is, as you pointed out, is that this is a breakthrough. I mean, a few years ago, we were just trying to get it so that it was permitted to have that in your possession and not be a felon, and particularly for a myriad of different diseases that you may have or that your children may have. So we got that passed, but the anomaly was you had to go to a place like Colorado, get the oil, and technically violate the law as you flew from Colorado back to Georgia with the oil in order to administer it either for yourself or your child in the case of epilepsy. And that just didn't make any sense. And my good friend Alan Peake has been working on this for a number of years. So now we'll at least have a distribution point here in Georgia within our state so that the folks don't have that concern of having to go out of state just to get the oil to come back. And I'll tell you this. You know, I remember having a mother and a child come to me and sort of talk about the importance of this bill in terms of taking care of her child who was epileptic, and her child was sitting there. And by the end of it, you know, and I must admit, I was a little bit of a questioning about the merits of the bill beforehand. But after the conversation, I told her, look, I'm not only going to vote for it, I'm going to go down there and sign the bloody bill. Because it is something that's very important. For the folks who suffer from particular diseases.
You know what, Michael, here's what I find ironic. We've just talked about concerns that some members of the legislature have about possible corruption in terms of the airport. Mm-hmm. You're now going to have contracts for two growers, 10 distribution centers. man, there's a lot of money if you're in among those 12 different organizations that have it. It'll be interesting to watch how they handle the awarding of those contracts.
You know, that's one thing that I know, as many others are keeping a very close eye on. You know, marijuana, you look around the country, is a very lucrative business, very much so. And as someone actually who went through Leadership Georgia last year, I can say I got a great appreciation for the agricultural community in this state. And I don't think it's too early to start talking about ensuring that we have some equity when it comes to making sure who we know these growers are, mm-hmm. and who the dispensaries are, and ensuring that there is a level playing field where people of all colors, socioeconomic, you know, that people can come together and get these contracts.
Yeah, I think number one, we need to remember that this is this now likely goes to a conference committee, so you're going to see some horse trading on the number of points of distribution, which has a great deal, which would have a great deal effect on the cost of the medicine to these people. The other thing I think interesting in the Senate bill is that it gives universities in Georgia a shot at looking at this trying to justify academically the powers and non-powers of medicinal marijuana. Now, I don't know whether they will bite on that, because you could put a lot of your federal grants in jeopardy if you get crossways with Washington.
Yeah, you have to be careful.
Let me interrupt because our intern, Morgan Carter, just whispered in my ear that the House has now taken up the agrees-disagrees on the fetal heartbeat bill. You're seeing right now, if you're watching us on Facebook Live, Ed Setzler in the well of the House, where he is making his argument for why House members should approve this measure. So, Jim, it's ironic in some ways that he talks about the way in which the General Assembly always defers to physicians. The Medical Association of Georgia has opposed this bill all along.
Right. And I would like, since we've got a lawyer in the House here.
Yeah, we do.
All right. What Setzler was talking about, as we cut away from him, he was talking about a list of affirmative defenses that are contained in the bill. Yeah. Exceptions under which a prosecution for abortion cannot occur.
Right.
And the last one, number five, is if the mother thinks she has a medical emergency and undergoes an abortion, even though she might not. Okay. So my question is, you have a lot of Democrats pointing to that. And in fact, Amy Steigerwalt
on the show
pointed to it and said, if you're giving an affirmative defense, if a woman thinks she has a medical emergency, there's an implication there that she could be prosecuted if she has an abortion and doesn't think she has a medical emergency.
Ed?
You know, that is a concern that I've heard. And quite frankly, you know, you add it to the list of a lot of concerns that folks have. And I'm not being flippant when I say that. There are several things about this bill that are problematic in terms of its enforceability.
All right. Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. But what you've just witnessed is truly a historic moment in Georgia. I mean, this is one of the most important measures that we've ever seen argued in the legislature, certainly in our modern history, Jim.
It will be one of the most restrictive anti-abortion measures in the country.
Okay, we'll watch and see, and if they end up taking that vote before we're off the air, we'll certainly let you know immediately. Let's take a break. This is Political Rewind.
I'm Ira Flatow. Mathematician Stephen Strogatz joins me on Science Friday to talk about the calculus you didn't learn in college. Plus, National Poetry Month is right around the corner. We'll talk to the U.S. Poet Laureate and a poet physician about where science fits into their craft. All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today at 3 on GPB and GPBnews.org.
A doctor who fled Venezuela 5 years ago now treats other Venezuelans walking hundreds of miles through Colombia.
To see people who can't walk in their shoes anymore and decide to go barefoot for hours and days in the sun, through rain, through cold, heat.
Following the path of Los Caminantes, Venezuelans leaving their country behind, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB and GPBnews.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. Ed Lindsay is with us, Michael Owens, Audrey Haynes, and Jim Galloway. Jim, let's just change subjects on the legislature for a moment. You had an interesting item in the Insider. You reported, you all, that there's now an effort by Republicans in the legislature up in Gwinnett County to postpone another vote on MARTA till
2026.
And that's been Charlotte Nash, the Republican chair of the Gwinnett County Commission, who's been for the MARTA expansion all along, had kept saying, this is not a period. It's a comma. We're going to go right away. And now she's got her own Republicans trying to put this off for another 8 years.
What they've done is they've attached a rider to Senate Bill 200, which mm-hmm. I think that is a DOT, a department bill of some things that they want. And it would bar another MARTA revote. And there's 2 points to make here. Number one is it's entirely likely that Democrats will take over the Gwinnett County Commission in 2020. So this is directly aimed at restricting them from what they could do. The other portion of this is, remember that in House Speaker David Ralston, you have a pretty strong advocate for transit in Metro mm-hmm. Atlanta. And that bill is going to have to come to a vote into his chamber. I'm not sure that it will make it.
All right. Well, we'll watch it.
This is a simple thing with this. The fact that this referendum was put into March and not November was the first sign that these legislators did not want the bill to pass, right? And yes, Chairman Nash has been a supporter of it, but I don't think she's indicated where she's running for re-election or not. Mm-hmm. And now it's obviously that she's, you know, probably couldn't be at more odds with her delegation in Gwinnett. But the problematic thing about this is that ultimately the voters need to decide what happens.
Yeah.
And not certain select individuals. And that's the problematic thing with this, is we have to let the voters decide. It needs to come back to a vote, and then let the Gwinnettians themselves decide, yeah. you know, and have their own destiny.
One thing I do want to remind folks of, even if something like this were to pass, there's a reason that we put things on paper and not chisel them in stone anymore. This is the sort of bill that could easily be changed next year or when the people of Gwinnett.
Yes, it could be, but it's going to slow down the ability to make this move forward.
You know, and I'm an advocate of transit,
and
I hope to see it come to Gwinnett. And I strongly believe that I don't know if it's going to be 2020 or 2022. But, you know, it needs to get back up for a full vote of the people in Gwinnett. I am reminded of the fact that in my area of the city of Atlanta and Fulton County, it took two tries to pass back in the 1970s, yeah. the creation of MARTA. And so the fact that it may take two tries in Gwinnett doesn't mean that it's dead.
Audrey, we should remember, of course, that it was Republicans on the commission up there who really, the only way they were going to vote for having a referendum was if the vote was held not in November in the general election, but was deferred until March, because they thought it would have a bigger chance of losing in March than if it had been on the general election ballot.
No, and strategically, we see that happen in our state very often. You know, we mentioned the limiting or passing of legislation to limit powers when there's the anticipation that the opposition party is going to come in. And, you know, and I would just say, ethically, I always find that to be terrible.
Well, there's the other side, though. And I do want to warn folks of this, is that that vote could have also been easily lost in the discussion in the 2018 general election,
right.
as opposed to being the sole thing on the ballot.
Right. I want to turn from the legislature for a few minutes here, Jim, as we come down toward the end of the show. I get the fact that the last thing that most people out there in the public, and perhaps our listeners as well, care about is the care and feeding of journalists and how we're treated out there. I acknowledge that. But there has been a very strange there was an incident in Savannah, which I'm told people in Savannah are talking about. There was a meeting of African-American leaders. We don't know if it was considered a public meeting or not, but they met to talk about selecting a single candidate to run for mayor against the white mayor who's now in office. Or because they have a white mayor in office, they're worried about that continuing. All right. They posted on the door a sign that said, "Black press only." Two African-American TV reporters were allowed to go in. Three white reporters, two from the Savannah Morning News, one white reporter from a TV station, you can't come in. Now, we hear from President Trump all the time about the fake media, But this situation, which suggests that access should be based on race, is a really troubling kind of development.
It is, and there was another restriction on there: no audio or video recording, which tells you that they wanted to be able to say things and not have it made public. Look, I might have hoped that the African American reporters might have kind of stood with their brethren of another color and not walked in on that. But what troubles me more is that it's kind of 1970s thinking in terms of racial demographics, and it's if you've been covering the city of Atlanta politics. They have run so hard away from thoughts like this. It's in the city of Atlanta, everyone knows you cannot win a single race. You can't run a single race campaign.
Well, Stacey Abrams would have argued against this because of the way she ran
her campaign. And that's her revolution. Her revolution is right. She has remade the biracial coalition for the Democratic Party.
Right.
It's based on different generations. It's based on different people, but it's got a future.
Yeah, Michael, yeah. I would, to some extent, it seems to me this is part of that tension that's going on down there between, you know, a government now, a city, county government that's having a hard time figuring out where what it is racially.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt from the face of this, it seems very troubling, right? You know, I wonder again, you know, public event, a private event, you know, I think when you go to the point of posting something on a door that certain people are not allowed, I don't care who that is, that gets very, very problematic.
I mean, if that had been a sign that said, you know, white reporters only, we would have every bit as much reason to be outraged as, the African American community would have ever been as much reason.
Just a little bit of more context here. What you did was you had Eddie DeLoach. It's a nonpartisan race, but he's a Republican. He won the mayoralty
right.
in 2015.
Right.
He drew Edna Jackson, the Democratic, an African American woman,
against
into
a
runoff.
Man. Yeah,
and he drew her in a runoff in part because there were two or three other candidates, and that's the situation that these people were trying to address down in Savannah this week. But there are ways to do that
it's one thing to go out and try to seek a coalition and sort of put forth the strongest mm-hmm. possible candidate for your point of view, but it's another one to overtly use to practice racism. And let's just face it, that's what
we're
it was.
When you deny you someone, get one comment, one Audrey.
Well, I wonder how they're not paying attention to politics around them, because that is such a rookie error to make, and it's going to hurt them, and they should have.
But they did. There was one candidate supposedly that spoke that said he was running on inclusion and progressivism.
Very quickly. Regina Quick, former state lawmaker, was one black candidate for mayor of Atlanta who did not go to that meeting.
Okay, we're out of time. I would just say, look, you know, we're not fake news. We really work hard at being accurate and honest. And goodness knows, we don't want to see a situation in which the white and black reporters are somehow put at odds with one another over this. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops in Savannah.
Regina Thomas.
Sorry. That's all right. Jim Galloway with that correction ends Political Rewind for today. We're back again on Monday at 2 o'clock. We appreciate all of you being with us out there. And my thanks to the panel for a great show today. Signy die next Tuesday.